Hi, everyone. This is Carl Lumley, Dr. Miles Hawkins, a.k.a. Mantis, and John Jones, the Martian Manhunter from the DC Animated Universe. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hello, comic book fanboys and fangirls. Welcome to Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber, kicking back in the Comic Book Central lair. About ready to welcome another talented actor to the show. This week, I'll be sitting down with Carl Lumley. Now, if you're a fan of the crazy sci-fi cult classic Buckaroo Banzai, the J.J. Abrams spy thriller Alias, the 90s super cool superhero Mantis, or the Martian Manhunter from Justice League Unlimited, you are in for a treat today. Carl's going to be joining me in just a few minutes. But before we sit down to chat, I got a few quick mentions. First, big thanks to everyone who's taken a moment to share the lair on Facebook and Twitter, especially with last week's Summer Glau episode. I really appreciate everyone getting the word out, clicking the like and share buttons on Facebook, retweeting the show. You guys and gals rock. I really appreciate each and every one of you listeners out there, especially those who have been sharing the show and getting the word out. There's a lot of new listeners joining in, so thanks to you as well for checking out the show. Hope you have a chance to go back and listen to some of the past episodes. There's a bunch of them out there, and I hope you stick around for the shows to come. Now, some other shows you're going to want to check out. If you're a fan of the classic and not so classic monster movies of yesteryear, you're going to want to head over to Monster Kid Radio. Producer and host Derek Cook does a fantastic job reliving some of those amazing scare fests that we all know and love. And once again, Derek and I joined up and wrapped up, pun intended, our coverage of the Abbott and Costello Meet the Monster series with Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. You can check out parts 1 and 2, and hey, while you're there, check out a ton of Derek's other incredible episodes and his great guests. You can check them all out over at monsterkidradio.net. You can also check out Monster Kid Radio on Facebook. You can subscribe in iTunes. Hey, just be sure to tell him Joe at Comic Book Central sent you. Thanks for having me on the show, Derek. I'm looking forward to our next get-together, hopefully pretty soon. And another fantastic show you're going to want to check out, if you haven't checked it out already, is the world's number one Indiana Jones podcast. That's right, the IndieCast. It's theindiecast.com. It's also on Facebook, iTunes, and over there on the Twitterverse as well.
Tune in each fortnight to the IndieCast, the world's number one Indiana Jones fan podcast.
Trust me.
Featuring the latest news, reviews, and interviews with on-screen and behind-the-scenes talent who helped bring to life the greatest adventure movie series ever made. Each episode has the latest from the world of Indiana Jones, as well as interactive segments, trivia, contests, and specials, including radio dramas and music retrospectives. The IndieCast.
It's a transmitter. It's a radio for speaking to God.
Available in iTunes or listen directly at theindiecast.com.
If adventure has a name, it must be the IndieCast.
Producer and host Ed Dalasta is about to celebrate the 7th anniversary and the 200th episode of the IndieCast. Incredible. Way to go, Ed. And I am proud to have been a part of the show for a few years now. So my thanks to Ed for that, for having me on the show. And once again, big congrats on the 7th anniversary. The big Indieversary blowout is set for November 17th. So be sure to check that out. And again, tell them Joe at Comic Book Central sent you. And speaking of anniversaries, well, it's not 7 years here, but it is the first anniversary of Comic Book Central. That's right. I launched this very podcast almost 1 year ago, premiered November 8th, 2013. And this year, I'm going to be celebrating in style with the 1 year anniversary special that's going to air Friday, November 7th. That's right. I'm going to bring back some of those memorable moments of the past year with guests like Stan Lee, Ilya Salkind, Aaron Gray, Jamie Alexander, Dean Cain, so many others. It's going to be episode 50 of Comic Book Central. That's right, 50. And while it's the anniversary of Comic Book Central, you are the one that could be getting the gift. That's right. The gift is the 1978 original Superman novel, Last Son of Krypton. It's the Superman the movie tie-in from 1978, and it features a sweet 16-page photo album of images from the classic movie. That could be yours. So just drop me a line at joe@comicbookcentral.net. You can click the Signal Me tab on the website, comicbookcentral.net. You can tweet me at comicbookctrl. Post on Facebook at facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. Or, hey, send me an MP3. I'd love to play some of the listener audio. Any of those means will work. Let me know what your favorite Comic Book Central moment was over the past year. Not only am I going to play that clip on the anniversary special, but I'm going to pick one listener's name at random, and that person is going to get Last Son of Krypton. So be sure to get those in, but your time is running out. There's only one other episode between this one and the anniversary show. So get those favorite moments in. Hey, maybe you're waiting to hear from today's guest before you choose your favorite moment. There's a lot of cool moments ahead. So I've got the Martian Manhunter's favorite snack, a plate full of Oreo cookies. It is sitting right out here in the lair, all ready for my guest, Carl Lumley. Born in Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes, to Jamaican parents, Carl's career path did not start off on the road to Hollywood. Now, a future as a reporter was on the horizon, until the acting bug bit Carl during a visit to an improv theater company. Well, journalism's loss was our gain, as Carl immersed himself in one amazing role after another, working with some of Hollywood's heaviest hitters. Critical acclaim came often, but so did those offbeat roles that we love so much. From the cult classic sci-fi, action, adventure, rock and roll comedy, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, to the sci-fi superhero Mantis, the mechanically augmented neurotransmitter interception system developed by Lumley's character, Dr. Miles Hawkins. Hawkins was paralyzed after a riot shooting, and the Mantis exoskeleton enabled him to not only walk, but he could take down criminals while he was wearing the suit and flying around in a super sweet hovercraft, the Chrysalid. Mantis was created by Batman screenplay writer Sam Hamm and Darkman Spider-Man director Sam Raimi. And it was a show ahead of its time. In a bold move by the Fox Network, the pilot movie was aired, featuring the first primetime African-American superhero, and it dealt with such heavy topics as gang violence, racism, and how society treats individuals with disabilities. The pilot scored huge ratings, but pulling a complete 180 in launching the series, the network brass eliminated the entire cast except Carl and developed storylines that were more fitting to the comic books than social commentary. Now, the show was short-lived, and one wonders what would have happened if Fox just let well enough alone. Ah, well, Mantis wasn't Carl's only experience portraying a superhero. Fans of DC Animation know him as the voice of John Jones, the shape-shifting Martian Manhunter on Justice League Unlimited, Justice League Doom, and now the world of DC video games. Well, my guest today is no stranger to the world of aliens and superheroes. He's even familiar with aliens who are superheroes. A big Comic Book Central welcome to Carl Lumley. Carl, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here in both my capacities and my multiple capacities.
Yeah, which shape have you assumed right now for us?
I'm in human form right now.
Yeah, as Carl Lumley, the actor. I think that one we recognize.
Yes.
Could this be true? I read in an old Starlog interview that your dad did not allow you to have comic books when you were a kid. That can't be right, could it?
Yes, that is absolutely correct.
My heart was
trash reading, and my father was an immigrant, and so he wanted me to read classics, read Shakespeare, read histories, read biographies, but never comic books. And he was very specific about the evils and the fact that it was frivolous, that it wasn't going to bring me to anything, that there was no real substance in it. And so after I was out of his house, I could do what I wanted. But while I was under his care, comics.
You rebel, you. Well, did you just go nuts and just start buying up like Superman comics and all kinds of things to see what you're missing all those years?
I will confess that his conditioning was pretty effective. I didn't ever develop a real love of comics until I began doing some of the voice work and some of the acting work. I think I began to read some of them just as a way to become familiar with what people were talking with, just sort of for my own leisure. But it wasn't until I actually started doing some of the voice work that I began to read them. And, what I find kind of fascinating is, of course, so much of it is based on classical works. So it's, all of the stories are the same, the betrayal, the redemption stories. I mean, they're all packed in there. And I think, Dad was a little hard on comic books.
Well, that obviously stayed with you, too, because even in that same interview, I read an interesting quote from you. You said, if Shakespeare were alive today, he'd probably be lifting things from Mantis.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't know that I can disagree with that either.
I think what I think was Shakespeare's brilliance, of course, was the fact that he was lifting from everything, that he was trying to make sense of the world for people who were not lettered, who, the masses who would come to his plays and who would get everything from the political and the cultural and, the social import would all be in there. And I would say not written down to them, but written clearly and plainly and writ large so that they would not only understand it, but feel it. So I think, he would have lifted from everything. I think he probably would have had a field day with South Park. And
would have been interesting to see credits these days. Screenplay by William Shakespeare. See what he would have done with some of these things too.
Yes.
Hey, let's talk about early gigs here. You and I have something in common. One of my early jobs was as a photojournalist. I was in television news. Cameraman,
right?
Photojournalist. So you got your start in broadcast journalism too, correct? Or not broadcast journalism?
Not broadcast,
it was written journalism,
print
journalism.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and in a weird way, that got you into acting too, though, didn't it?
Yes, I was assigned a freelance story about an improvisational acting company in Minneapolis who had lost 5 of their actors in one fell swoop to Los Angeles. They all had decided they were going to come west and seek their fortune. So this company, Dudley Riggs Breed New Workshop, not unlike Second City, held public auditions, and I was assigned to go do a story about that. I arrived early, ended up on the wrong side of the room, ended up getting an audition card, and decided that would be the best perspective from which to write a story, some individual who was trying desperately to become a part of this company, and after that failed, what it was like sitting there watching other people compete and ultimately be getting cast. But as luck would have it, and I do think of it as my great luck, I ended up getting cast. I was one of the 5 people that they selected, and even though I demurred at first and tried to get them to cast someone else, they persisted, and I thought it might be interesting to try, and I was hooked.
Now, did you have improv skills? I mean, do you just have a natural ability for improv, or was it your personality, or what was it that was like, no, that's the guy we want?
I believe it was, I've always been a big reader and a big writer, so I think it was sort of like writing on my feet in a way. And I had access to so many stories and situations, and that was what it was based on. You would be given a situation and then just sort of asked to operate off the top of your intelligence. I don't think my performance skills were that great, but my verbal skills were very good. So I think that's kind of what got me by. And then once I discovered this was the work I really wanted to do, then I had to get a lot of training, most of which I got sort of on-the-job training working in theater. And then when I went to New York, I was able to do a lot of workshops and begin to develop my love and love for the discipline of acting as well as the act itself.
Did you get to improv with Danny Glover there as well?
No, Danny and I, we ended up doing probably a lot of improv, but the work that we did together was Cesare Bonzi's Dead on the Island, these two written scripted plays by South African playwright named Athol Fugard. And when I moved to San Francisco after a couple of weeks, when I first came, my old bureau chief at Associated Press told me that he'd have an opening in a couple of weeks if I would hang on. And so I said I would, and I was looking through the newspaper trying to find used furniture. And in San Francisco, they had a performing arts column, which we didn't have one in Minneapolis. And the ad was two black actors needed for South African political plays. I was intrigued, went to the library, got the plays, read them, and my mind was blown. It was incredible work, but it was also such political work, and it kind of opened my eyes to another possibility about what acting could be. So I went to this theater. There was an actor there, Danny Glover. We ended up getting cast, worked together, toured it for the California Arts Council up and down the coast, and ended up doing it in Los Angeles, where we got agents. I actually didn't care for L.A., so I was there for a year, and then I moved to New York and ended up getting cast in Cagney and Lacey. Six episodes, came back out here, did them.
Yeah, that was your first major role, correct?
Yes, was my first big TV role.
What training ground you had?
It was canceled.
Well, yeah, but still, I mean, you know, what training ground with these actors that you got to I mean, this is right out of the gate. These are early roles for you.
Yes. Tyne Daly, Danny Glover.
Morgan Freeman? Did you get to work with Morgan Freeman?
Morgan and I worked together in theater. I did a piece called Gospel at Colonus. And Morgan and I did that. I actually understudied for Morgan at times when he couldn't do the role. And we got an opportunity to literally sit almost as an apprentice to some of these individuals, to watch what they did, learn how they did it, and work with them. It was quite tremendous. And again, I say, I was lucky.
Well, and yeah, and I'm sure your talent had a little bit to do with it too. And for some of our listeners who are kind of going like, whoa, he got all these things right. Your first film was Escape from Alcatraz.
Yeah.
Starring Clint Eastwood and directed by legendary Don Siegel, who was Clint Eastwood's mentor. So he's learning from Don, you're learning from Clint. My goodness, what did you learn on the set of Escape from Alcatraz? I'm a huge Clint Eastwood fan, so it's one of my favorite movies.
I learned a lot about economy.
Yeah.
That was, I think, the thing that struck me most about Clint Eastwood. He wasn't simply taciturn. He was just he just didn't need to use a lot of language, a lot of words. He was very direct, and he sort of stayed within himself. And I think that is something that I took to heart. You know, you're expending a tremendous amount of energy when you're called upon to do the work itself. So it's probably a good idea to hold on to as much as you can. And unlike stage, you don't have to amplify a tremendous amount. So it's more important to secure what you have for the character inside yourself. And then be, I think, fairly economical in the way you go about spending it. And, you know, a set can drain you. So if you're too involved jumping around a lot, when it's time to do the work, you can be a little dissipated. So he was very, very, he was very disciplined, very economical. From Tyne Daly, her watchwords were richer, fuller, deeper, better. Anything that you can do once, you can do richer, fuller, deeper, or better. So I got that from her. Morgan's interesting because Morgan is a very, very serious cat with a wild sense of humor, and he's got a twinkle. That's the best way I can say it. So he sees sort of the human frailty and the human folly in situations, and that became something that I look for in my characters as a way to love them. You have to love everyone that you play. You have to find that love, and when you're playing someone who might, I don't know, not be as appetizing to you, you have to overlook that and find the things that you really love. So, I've gleaned, picked up tidbits, and I think the other thing I believe is that it's work. Some people may have just a plain gift that allows them to be right the first time. Their instinct might just be that excellent. But for me, I work very hard. I make choices, and then try to execute them.
Well, you appear to have made the correct decision in getting involved in that local improv theater company all those years ago. And my goodness, what an acting score you had. That's amazing. Well, let's see how some of those acting lessons and all those different techniques you worked out worked into some of my favorite genre projects, some of our listeners' favorite genre projects. Again, an early role. One of the craziest films of all time and one of my favorites, and I'll be honest, I haven't seen this movie, I don't think, since I was a kid. I need to revisit this because it's probably one of those movies you just need to see a billion times. The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. You play John Parker. We talked about aliens.
That was
your first name. Yes, exactly.
A true Lectroid, as I remember, yes.
Did you get to sort of channel your Jamaican heritage a little bit with this character? Because when they take human form, they're kind of like in this, what is it, like a Rastafarian or something, or a Jamaican?
Yes.
What is, and yes, it's, if for people who haven't seen it, just, if you could, I don't even know if you could tell in a sentence what it's about, but it's one of the nuttiest movies of all time.
Yeah, it is. It's about an experiment that is too effective that ends up allowing people to cross into the eighth dimension, and beings from the eighth dimension, a parallel dimension to our own, enter into this dimension. One of those is. A madman who has come through some years prior, played by John Lithgow. And then there are other creatures, black Lectroids. I am one of the black Lectroids. And so the madman is trying to take over the Earth, don't they always? And
world domination, of course, that old trope.
Yes. And the Lectroids are just trying to get home. So they're contacted by Buckaroo Banzai, who is a combination brilliant scientist, cowboy, rock musician, and
he's a surgeon.
He has an entourage of uniquely talented roadies and assistants who take on this challenge of they realize that the eighth dimension has been breached, and they work very hard to save the Earth and return the black Lectroids home and rid the world of John Lithgow's character, who's a red Lectroid.
Whew, and all that. I mean, how do you, as an actor, approaching it? And that cast, too. Peter Weller, John Lithgow, you mentioned, Ellen Barkin, Ronald Lacey, one of our favorites from Raiders of the Lost Ark, Jeff Goldblum, Christopher Lloyd,
right.
All at the top of their game. Your future Justice League voiceover actor, Clancy Brown, he's in it. I mean,
Clancy Brown, yes.
How do you tackle this as an actor? Like, would you get the script or you're like, what? Or do you just hit the mark, say your lines, and hope for the best?
You just leap into it. And then I think there was the script itself, but then there was also the process, which was completely free form. I don't know how much you remember about that set, but it was like wandering through the detritus of someone demented's mind. things laying about, pieces of fruit, all of which on the day came to be a part of the film. It was so much fun. It was just a romp. Actors were allowed to, play. And I think what came out of it might not always have been coherent, but it was an awful lot of fun. And I'm tickled by the fact that as time has gone on, people have really responded to it.
It's probably more popular now than it was. I mean, because when it came out, I don't think people knew what to do with it. I mean, I saw it in the theaters as a kid. I thought it was one of those cool things. So, but like today, it's considered like a cult classic. People love it.
Yes. At the time, it was confusing for people. I think people were entertained by it, but they kind of didn't understand really the sense of humor that I think was so much a part of it. And the fun that it was having with not only the story itself, but with the genre. This idea of Peter Weller's character can do everything. And again, is just looking for love.
Aren't we all? Is that the human condition? We just want to be loved.
All those scenes, trying to get home, looking for love, trying to set records, understand things about the world we live in, science, and rock music.
What more do you want? Got it all. Anyone ever talk to you about a sequel? Nothing ever come out of this?
Not to my knowledge. Okay. I think people were just inclined to rest after the first one.
Well, maybe we can revisit it. Who knows at some point. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about another cool project, Alias, before we get to some of the comic book stuff. But Alias, how difficult was it to keep up with Jennifer Garner as Sidney Bristow's partner at SD6?
It was just a joy. Again, another romp. What a tremendous talent! What a superb person, and what a meteoric rise in stardom! And all of which she handled with aplomb and graciousness, grace, and intelligence. Quite an amazing person. So keeping up with her, I didn't attempt to do that. I'm a little older.
Get out of her way, right?
I think it was fun to go stride for stride, especially in the early going of the series. It really was an ongoing revelation and very gratifying the way audiences found us and championed us and kept us going for some seasons.
Again, I've got to ask the question. I'm sure you've had it a million times. Any chance of Alias returning, working with JJ again? What are we looking at? Anything?
Well, that would be a hope. Again, I'm out of the loop for what goes on administratively. I pretty much come in and do my characters and then try to keep my life in motion. So I don't know, but I will say that working with JJ was absolutely superb. What a genius talent and a quite wonderful individual, a family man. And yes, he had his own family, but I think his concept for the way this all works is it's all about family. So it was one of the best working environments that I think I've had the privilege of being a part of. So, and I've been a part of some good ones, so I consider myself, again, quite fortunate.
Yeah,
and I would be willing to sign on your heartbeat if it does find a way to reunite us, or if anything else is going on. But sometimes these things make their mark, and the initial statement is sort of what stamps it. And I don't know.
I know, but speaking for the fan base, you know how we get. It's we just want more. When we like something, we just want more of it. So I know we can never get enough. Yep. We can never leave well enough alone. So, hey, what do you say we fire up the chrysalid, put Mantis online, the mechanically augmented neurotransmitter interception system. It's Mantis. This was a pretty cool show. I don't know that it got the break that it needed to get, but we're looking at mid-90s here on Fox. 22 episodes created by Sam Hamm from the 1989 Batman film and Sam Raimi.
Sam Raimi.
From Darkman and Spider-Man. They were in the pilot. Actually, I think Sam appears in the pilot, doesn't he?
Absolutely. And I think that their stamp was on the pilot. After the pilot, a different production team came on, a different set of writers came on. So the series was a different animal, and I consider it Mantis 1 and Mantis 2.
Yeah, but very different.
They were... Their idea for that pilot was, I thought, quite brilliant. And I think, you know, we did the best we could as we moved forward. But Mantis, for me, the incarnation that I thought was the most inventive and powerful was that pilot, which, you know, at the time was one of Fox's most successful pilots. And
The ratings were there, really, right off the pilot.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, in this, it's a really strong pilot. If nobody's had a chance to see it, I mean, it's on iTunes. You can download it and get it. But in the pilot, we've got fan favorite Gina Torres from Firefly, who is amazing in this pilot. I mean, you guys are fantastic in this. We've got your character, who, I mean, it's interesting too. When there's so many layers. When we're talking about this, when we talk about Dr. Miles Hawkins, I mean, he's shot in the pilot. He loses, you know, the use of his legs. He's in a wheelchair. So there's a lot of things going on with him in this suit he can show. He's kind of like Tony Stark, Iron Man, before Robert Downey Jr. I mean, he's like this military industrialist. He creates this suit that allows him to do. So. What were the conversations you had with the Sams initially going in on this character? How did you understand the character of Miles Hawkins?
Well, the understanding was basically this is a man of science who was also a businessman who, for whatever reason, after he was shot and paralyzed and had to live in the wheelchair, he had a choice, and his choice was bitterness, or to turn his mind toward improving the world in which he lived, a world in which he could be shot, and improving it for as many people as possible. So the work that he was doing was essentially to make an exoskeleton. And, you know, today these things actually exist, and there are people benefiting from the idea of this device. This
sort of prosthetic. This electrified prosthetic that's like battery powered and like enables him to do amazing things.
So what was super about him was his mind and his heart and his intention. So his powers were powers that anyone can have. And I think that's what intrigued me about it, because he was putting his focus on trying to improve his world. And his the caveat was nobody gets killed. That he was paralyzing people, stopping them in the act of, and then allowing the police to come and pick them up. But he did not want to. He did not want to kill people.
Yeah, I think Gina even asked you about that in the pilot. Like you're flying the chrysalid, and you're being, you know, shot at with these missiles and things. And she's like, "Can't you shoot them?" He's like, "You're like, I don't have any offensive weapons." She's like, "What?"
Yes, exactly. Like, that's not how we do it.
It's not how it works. It's anti-violence.
Right, and there were so many aspects of it that I thought were just superb. So my understanding of the character was that it was he was not only going to fight crime, but in the manner in which he fought crime, he wanted to reduce violence and killing in the world. So it was and we managed from, I think, the through the rest of the series to keep him from killing. There might have been a couple of instances where somebody died as a result of something he did, but he tried not to kill intentionally. As we move forward with the series, I think the idea of a police conspiracy that had brought about his paralysis that got left behind. He had two African scientists, two sort of young scientists that he was bringing along that was let go of. And he had he took on a British partner who became his sort of M. And so there were various elements that yeah. changed.
Well, that was a lot. That was a source of controversy, I think, too. I think there was a New York Times article that mm-hmm. quoted you as well, and so I want to touch on that as much as you're comfortable with. But I know that initial yes. pilot, it dealt with so many different layers. I mean, they're talking about gang violence, inner city violence. Mm-hmm. You yes. got people with disabilities, how they are talked to, how they the relationships they have with individuals, how they're seen by others, mm-hmm. racism. Obviously, through that entire the entire movie, the TV movie, that comes up all the way through. So you mentioned yes. that, and then so I thought, wow, that's some heavy stuff for Fox to be dealing with in the mid '90s on TV. And then you get the ratings, and then all of a sudden the show gets picked up, but everything changes. You're the only one that's kept. It's like you're the only.
I was. So,
you talk about that a little bit because I know you were kind of upset in that New York Times article a little bit about that.
Yes, I was. I think that, Fox had been very, very brave in doing the pilot. I think that the results normally would have resulted in the pilot being advanced and not changed. But I think for whatever reasons, the fear, and perhaps because it was unusual, and because it did deal with so many things, I think, people maybe lost heart. And so in my mind, the pilot was sort of deconstructed and reconstructed in a more traditional sort of traditionally palatable format, which was not as palatable for me.
You're being nicer than you were in the article. I will say that. I know it's we're going back.
I'm trying to keep myself from going back to how I initially felt.
It's so strange because
really,
today
I mean, understand it.
Yeah, it wouldn't even be an issue today. And it's just like you look in the comic books. It's like Captain America is now an African American. Captain America, the Winter Soldier. We've got the Falcon, coming in and saving the day. And it's just like, you see this, and it's like it was so ahead of its time. And it's like, boy, there's an opportunity there, and then it just got retooled to something that's more standard.
And I'll share with you, Joe. It was so far ahead of its time that one of the reviewers that struck me the most in taking issue with the pilot. He could accept the development of the suit. He could accept the chrysalid. What he couldn't accept was the idea that there was a black man who was a physicist and the CEO of his own company. And literally, that was his largest point of contention. So I think there was an awful lot that had to be overcome, and that... Fox might have grown a little faint-hearted in being willing to tackle all of that. I'm sorry that they didn't. And at the time, I was pretty vocal. And for me, no pun intended, it was pretty black and white. It would have been possible to change certain elements of it, but I think there was a complete... as someone said to me, well, at least you're here.
Well, and I think that's probably that's the challenge you probably found yourself in, because Gina in that article was very vocal about it as well. She's very specific about it. and because she wasn't carried over, which was, her character is amazing. But it just it was so wildly different than anything else that was on at the time. And I think it's almost like reminds me of like that character of Mantis would have been comfortable in like the 70s Marvel comics, you know, like when you had Luke Cage and you had the Black Panther and like they were doing all these innovative things that, that people hadn't seen before. And it just seems to me like that was such an opportunity to take that and kind of run with it. But again, it's Hollywood, it's TV, you gotta, you know.
The biggest loss for me was the loss of the relationships between Black people, African Americans, on different levels. The gang level, you know, Gina's character, my character, the two African scientists. So there was, a, in a way, a sort of a restitching of the diaspora and bringing relationships back into being. And that was exciting, and I think that was an opportunity lost.
Yeah, and they were, what was it, Wendy Raquel Robinson and Christopher Brown? They're like, they get in the van and like follow you around, and they're kind of like, you're in the bat cave or the mantis cave, you know, and they're like, they're kind of like directing you and juicing you up. I mean, that, the whole thing is cool, and you've got almost like the Batmobile and the bat cave. I mean, you've got all those elements that, that would bring in the comic book fans, but then. It's almost like Gene Roddenberry in the 60s with Star Trek. He like he's like, I want to say all these messages, but I got to couch it in all these things so nobody knows what I'm talking about. Maybe it was just too overt for its time. Maybe they should have just been a little more subtle with things, and maybe they, you know, did a Roddenberry aspect too. Who knows?
Well, I think Sam Pound and Sam Raimi, I stand by that pilot. I think that they had... I think they had tremendous vision, and they were hoping that it would take. I don't personally think they did too much. I just think it was a question of timing and the difficulty that some people had embracing something that was as bold as I think it was as a statement. But it will forever be a point of pride with me that I was a part of it. I think we did a very nice piece of work. And as it's as that pilot stands alone, relative to the rest of the series, I'm proud of both entities.
Yeah, you get both. You get the best of both worlds. You watch the movie, you get you know. I think depth of character, but then you want you know all the comic booky stuff, and you get the series too, and you still live. I mean, you kind of don't, but then there's the whole time travel thing, and your character technically survives. So hey, comic book movies are blowing up. Maybe Mantis 2.0. Maybe we'll get a movie. You know, the Sams
I'm
get back together.
You,
who knows? It'd be cool.
I think there's a there are a number of characters that I've done that I would love for them to come back because I would be it'd be interesting to get into them now. I've had the benefit of having a career. I've learned a lot more, and it would be a great deal of fun.
That would be classic. And when you were filming it, your son was six. What did he think of Dad as a superhero?
He thought spandex was funny. I don't share that view. Spandex was never funny to me. he loved the chrysalid. He came on the set, not in the pilot, but when we were doing the series, and it was like a wonderland for him. Running around, and that again was something that I was really really happy to share. You know, he laughed about a lot of it. He loved the idea of freezing people, and we had the occasion to play some freezing games.
Dad in the full suit and everything.
Yes.
I mean, you had to be greatest dad ever at that point. I mean, and for him to be that's the perfect age.
It was tremendous, and I tell you, the other aspect of it was the wheelchair. And the fact that I gained a great deal of facility in the wheelchair and that it became, you know, for him, there were some people who this was their conveyance. This was their way of moving about in the world. And I really wanted him to see that differently abled people are not necessarily disabled. It's just their pathway through empowerment takes a different turn, and in many ways what they have to develop is perhaps even greater than what we do, that maybe they truly are super beings relative to those of us who don't have those particular challenges. And I still to this day marvel at, wheelchair basketball and the individuals who compete in marathons. And, it says something about the human spirit and the indomitability of it, that you can take whatever life may throw at you and allow yourself to rise above it. And that I think is a kind of a superhuman quality.
Oh, so many great messages, many great layers to Mantis. Let's hope it comes back. Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
One other superhero your son got to see, or at least hear, the Martian Manhunter. And how do you pronounce
John
it?
John Jones.
Is that okay? Because I'm, I plead some amount of ignorance because, like, I love the Justice League. I know he's a founding member. I don't think I ever knew that much about Martian Manhunter. What did you know about the character when you took over the role?
Yes. My understanding of Martian Manhunter was that he was a character at one point, and then he had gone away, and our version of Justice League was bringing him back. And his story struck me because he was the last of his kind, only Martian left who had been left behind to essentially monitor his dead planet, that he had lost all of his other fellow Martians, and that in this incarnation he was given a second chance, an opportunity to come back and find a new life, albeit a strange one, with these human beings and these super beings who set up this this watch and who try to move about saving little bits of the world incrementally, who have petty jealousies and who can't discorporate the way he can, who have relatively young memories because his memory goes back a long ways and he's been alive a long time, but he doesn't, he hasn't had the opportunity to share his heart with anyone in quite some time. And so as we moved through, he very gradually was transformed. He was, he had, compatriots, and he had a kind of a home, and he had purpose again. And ultimately, he goes back out into the world. He gets married and finds himself. I tell you, I was tickled to death during Jean Jones. I loved the way his voice changed. I loved the way he started off kind of completely unto himself and not really understanding but wanting to help, and then beginning to really appreciate people. There were a couple of episodes where taken home for Christmas, and
is this the one where you get to sing?
Yes, yes. that was a wholly improvised Martian holiday tune.
How did Andrea Romano direct you with it? Like, what was your conversation with voice director Andrea Romano over that?
The way she always does. She's so intuitive. She's such a sweet person, and she's so sort of capable and true. And so we talked about what this would be, what it would mean to him. And then she opened the microphone and said, "So, what do you think?"
And action.
And allowed this. I think part of what Andrea does is she removes whatever would make you feel uncomfortable about being yourself inside a character, and allows you to just sort of run free. So obviously, I'm not completely wrapped tight as an individual psychologically, and I fully welcome these moments of abandon inside my own head and my own heart. And so,
well, you're an actor. You
want
to act.
That's what I was able to attach to. Yes, absolutely. That's exactly right.
Well, and it seems so, because the voice actors we talk to in the DC animated universe say it's so much different than, like, if you're doing something for Disney where it's like so structured and you got to get each line specifically right. Whereas these are more like radio plays, from what we're told, is where you get the cast together.
Oh, that's so true. Yeah. That is so very, very true. And again, these are things that I was surprised, because I thought, well, you know, comic books are written for children. But the stories are all amazing stories for all people. Very, very sophisticated, very nuanced, very, very challenging things that we were doing. This whole idea that, you know, you didn't wake up as a superhero every day and just feel good about going out and fighting crime, or that you know, that you could feel like somebody gets more attention in the group than I do, or you could fail to understand why, you know, someone like Batman, sometimes he's just rough. You know, what he wakes up on the wrong side of his cape. he just, you know what I mean? What is his problem? And so... And, you know, the fact that, yeah, Catwoman's kind of hot, and, you know, Hawkgirl and Wonder Woman. I mean, you know, it's people doing what they normally do. It just happens that they also have this task of trying to protect the world.
See what you're missing all these years? Not when Dad wouldn't let you read comic books?
I'm telling you, every once in a while, you know what, between the two of us, these graphic novels. Oh my goodness, this is a treasure trove. This is the naughty stuff for me. And my father passed in 84, and sometimes I still feel like he's looking over my shoulder. Of course, now I'm my own man. And I go,
you're like doing the research on these things and reading, you know, like you should be under the covers with a flashlight.
Yes, and the fact is, you know, my son is the one who has turned me out completely. So it's, you know, I'm caught between generations and loving it.
Wow. You said, Dad gave you all the, you know, the Shakespeare and all. So, like, I think that you, because when you watch your performances, you certainly see that level of intensity and that weight and all that experience coming into those things, even if we're talking about Mantis or, you know, Martian Manhunter and things like that. I think that you bring that in as the actor.
Well, I love story. I love writing. I love writers, and I marvel continually in the way that they are able to capture, you know, the realities of being human, and I get an opportunity then to try and amplify that in my work. I take it very seriously. I take the work seriously. Myself, not so much. I kind of get a kick out of the fact that I know who I am, but because of some of the work I've gotten to do, I think people have an impression of me as being, you know, quite a serious cat, which is fine. I'm happy with that, but nothing could be further from the truth. And I love doing this. I love this opportunity that you know, good luck gave me. I still love writing. I still do a great deal of writing, but I'm not sure that I would have achieved the same success as a writer that I feel like I am in the process of achieving as an actor.
Well, I say it's as a, you know, as a fanboy, and again, speaking for an audience of fanboys and girls, it's cool to hear the actors say that they get a kick out of doing these projects, and to know that you're like, every now and again, you've got a graphic novel that you're kind of sneaking in on the side.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool too.
Yeah.
And we got the video games and Doom, the straight to video movie. So who knows? We've got more Martian Manhunter. There's plenty of DC animated projects. So hopefully we haven't heard the last of Martian Manhunter for you.
Well, I think, you know, as long as people continue to value imagination, you know, I'll have something to do, something to look forward to. And now that the internet is what it is, who knows what the next iteration of all of this will be. It's very, very exciting. And as I say, my son has brought me into a new and better understanding of what's possible. And the fact that, you know, many of the a lot of interesting work being done now in web series, and you know, it's all I think all challenging the industry to do better and better work, and so that's upside all the way.
Well, one of these projects we can talk about, you're up in Canada shooting The Returned. Is that accurate?
Yes, yes, that's right.
Oh, this seems interesting.
It is, and I can't talk a lot about it. It's based on a French series called The Returned, which has been on Netflix, I think, for a couple of seasons, maybe two seasons.
And so we'll just go watch it on there and know all about it, right?
Version of it.
So we can speak French.
Well, this is the American version of it, which will be, I suppose, the same and different.
Well, we know Carlton Cuse is the executive producer. He was the executive producer on Lost. So it's going to go in a weird direction here, isn't it? We don't know what to expect.
No question. No question. It's probably the most interesting town you could ever want to wander into. I will put it that way.
Okay. And, people who shouldn't be there are reappearing, something like that. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. There's a returned aspect to some of the people who live there.
Are you one of the returned?
No, I was always there, and now I'm one of the witnesses to the fact that somehow people are coming back.
Dun dun dun. Okay. When can when can we see this? When can we see your
I believe that it's going to be starting at the beginning of the year, January or March is my understanding.
And where can we see it?
On the A&E channel.
Oh, fantastic. This is a 10-episode, one of their 10-episode series?
Initial commitment, yes.
Excellent. We'll look for that the beginning of the year, too. And you're hitting the stage again?
Yes, I'm doing a couple of plays. I live in the Bay Area, San Francisco, and I'll be doing a couple of plays up here. In particular, in March, I'm doing one at our theater, ACT, a production of a beautiful play called Let There Be Love, which allows me an opportunity to be West Indian again, and is sort of centered around the music of Nat King Cole.
Oh, my goodness, fantastic.
Yeah.
I wish I were on the West Coast. Play.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know if this will be filmed or not. And I believe this play was in New York at one point, some years ago, or London and then New York. So I'm just happy to have an opportunity to do it, and yeah.
Fantastic. Well, how can fans find out more about it? Website, Facebook, Twitter, where can we find you?
I'm challenged in those areas.
Are we all? I know.
Yes. I would say keep your ears open.
Keep your... Watch that IMDb page.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It'll all end up there.
But I say, look, just because you can build a Manta suit on TV doesn't mean you can build one in real life, right? Yeah, Robert Downey Jr. is not building the Iron Man armor. So, hey, no worries. You know, we just talked to John Rhys-Davies. He's gone dark on social networks. I don't blame him.
Well, which sounds like he was light at one point. My hat's off to him. I have not even turned it on yet.
No, but I don't think he did either. Yeah, I think you guys are just... Yeah. I think you guys have figured it out. Just stay stealth.
I'm moving into the 21st century, and my son says that, you know, he's not finished with me yet, so...
well, it's crazy, because you play all these characters, and I think people think, you know, of the characters, and you're like, well, you know, of course he knows all about computers and sci-fi and all these different things, so...
Well, I'm very confused.
That shows you what a great actor you are.
Social media is tricky for me. I think, you know, I think I've always been sort of... content to be behind my characters, and I think that's a comfortable spot for me. So in fact, maybe the larger and broader the character, the happier I am, because it's that much further away from me.
That's an interesting take.
On it,
that's an interesting. No, you get, you know, you like that privacy, so it's very good too. So hey, well, you know, continued success in all you do. We hope to hear more from you as the Martian Manhunter. We hope to see Mantis maybe again one of these days. That would be awesome. But
that would be great.
Whatever characters you embody, we're looking forward to it. So, Carl Lumley, thank you so much for joining me on Comic Book Central today.
Thank you, Joe. You have a good one, man.
All of the episodes of Mantis are available for download on iTunes, and hopefully they'll re-release the DVD box set at some point. I checked it online, and it is a bit pricey for the one that's out there. But you can download the whole season on iTunes. Check it out. It's a pretty cool ride. My thanks to Carl Lumley for joining me on the show today. And hey, don't forget, folks, the Comic Book Central one-year anniversary special is going to be online November 7th, so get your favorite show moments to me. I'm going to play those on the special, and you'll get your shot at scoring that super cool Superman novel, Last Son of Krypton. It is awesome. It's Joe at comicbookcentral.net if you want to email. Post it on Facebook at facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. Tweet it at comicbookctrl, or send it to me at the Signal Me link on the website, comicbookcentral.net. But the anniversary special is not here yet. One more episode to go before we get there, and it is a fun one, because next week on Comic Book Central, get ready to time travel back to the 70s as I welcome the beautiful and talented actress who made Saturday mornings Elektra awesome. From Elektra Woman and Dinah Girl, it's Dinah Girl. Actress Judy Strangis will be here to talk about fighting crime in a cape, spandex, and pigtails. Don't miss it, kids. Until then, have a sensational week. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the Lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported License. All of the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Who are you?
Call me the Mantis.